This is from the Midwest City Free Baptist Church.
You're thinking to yourself, if you've been here the last few weeks, when are you going to stop talking about Saul of Tarsus? I'm into Paul. I don't like Saul. Why are we still talking about him? Well, I mean, look, we overlook the man he was a lot of times because there's plenty of writing and speaking and learning and preaching about Paul. Plenty of that. And just not that often do we spend that much time thinking about the guy he was. But really, it only throws more light on how amazing it is who Paul was. Right? Doesn't it just reemphasize to you what a miraculous thing it is when you just keep going back to look at who he was? So, we talked about him, but we hadn't yet really talked about his conversion, about what this means, the idea that he had this amazing conversion. So, Acts chapter 9, which we already read last week, here it comes again. Because last week we didn't get that far. We're focused on the persecutor he was, but the persecutor ran into a real fork in the road here. So, Acts chapter 9, once again, starting at the top. But Saul, the old familiar one, Saul, still breathing threats and murder against the disciples of the Lord, went to the high priest and asked him for letters to the synagogues at Damascus, so that if he found any belonging to the way, that is the Christian movement, the church, men or women, he might bring them bound to Jerusalem. So he wants to go arrest them. So off he goes. And now, as he went on his way, he approached Damascus, and suddenly a light from heaven shone around him, and falling to the ground. Boy, we should call this the road to Damascus. That'd be a cool name for this account, wouldn't it? I think I'll start referring to it as that. A light, okay, shone around. He falls to the ground, and he heard a voice saying, "Saul, Saul, why are you persecuting me?" And he said, "Who are you, Lord?" And he said, "I am Jesus whom you are persecuting. But rise and enter the city, and you will be told what you are to do." The men who were traveling with him stood speechless, hearing the voice, but seeing no one. Saul rose from the ground, and although his eyes were opened, he saw nothing. So they led him by the hand and brought him into Damascus. And for 3 days he was without sight, and neither ate nor drank. And there it is again, the account, the very famous account of this mother of all conversions, this most important of conversions. Now, since the church began, since the church was born in all times and in all places, one thing has always been true. There are many things that have been true, but one of them is that everywhere that the gospel has ever gone, everywhere it's taken root, there have always been transformations of people. This has always followed everywhere the church goes, people just, you know, their lives get altered, and there are changes that happen. Some conversions, of course, are far more dramatic than others. That's true, right? And it's not a requirement that a conversion have to be dramatic, but some are. Some are. So, it still happens today. I want you to consider now this account. So, there was an ancient conversion account, but let me show you a recent conversion account. This headline from just a year ago: former Muslim who hated Christians plants first church in town, or first church town has seen in 700 years. Former Muslim who hated Christians plants first church town has seen in 700 years. And so it begins saying, a man is helping take the gospel to the four corners of the earth by planting the first church a town in Kosovo has seen in 700 years. It's a story with an unlikely beginning. Yurim Bogaj grew up in a Muslim family that hated Christians. Now, I have a little more here that's not on the screen. But everything changed, he says, when his aunt converted to Christianity. Okay, she converted in 99 after a bloody war rocked their small southeastern European country. She shared her new faith with the then 15-year-old Yurim, who found it very hard to accept. Quote, "It was hard to listen to her, hard to receive what she had to say. We always knew that Christians were serpents, and serpents are evil. So I did not want to be a Christian, he told the Global News Alliance. But to make a real long story short, Yurim ultimately, reading the Bible, she keeps urging him to read, keeps talking to him, and ultimately, Yurim gave his life to Christ. So this former Muslim, finally, it happened. So he's a changed man. And from there, the process started. And now in this article it says, you know, since that time, his whole family ends up being... First, they're shocked. You know how this goes. First, they're stunned. First, they don't know what to do with him. But despite this, over the course of time, his entire family ultimately would be Christian. And here he is now, as of last year, he's planting a church in Malashave. Anyone ever visited Malashave? Okay. Yeah. In Malashave in Kosovo, the first one that the majority Muslim town has seen in 700 years. Quote, there were challenges, he said. There were all kinds of problems and there was persecution of every kind. Yeah, I can well imagine. So, what a story, huh? Story, let's consider this now. The story of a young man who really hates Christians, who then is transformed into someone who plants new churches in pioneering areas. Well, there's a storyline for you. Young man, hates Christians, transformed into someone planting churches in pioneer areas. It sounds a little familiar. Is that a new story? That is not a new story. That's an old story. That's the story of the man we just read about in that ancient conversion account. A man who hated Christians. Right? And so, this is now such a person we're introduced to in Acts. Just such a person like that. And his conversion, I mean, obviously, of all the conversions that ever happened in the world, there aren't that many as dramatic as Saul's. Now, this guy, speaking of a wild child, you know, so Saul's as wild a child as it come. Now, you know, I already beat the horse here. The horse he may have fell off of. I don't know if he was riding a horse when it happened. But I beat the horse already. Everything that's bizarre about this guy, everything unique about this man. All right, the great Pharisee, studied under the great the leading rabbi Gamaliel. He's got all the cultural stuff down. He's born in a leading Greek city with the university. He's very well trained. He speaks Greek as well as anybody could. He's a Roman citizen. That was very rare. That was quite an honor. He's got all that going for him. But the important thing about him in this chapter is that he really hates him some Christians, and he's going after them. And of course, I said last time, remember, that Saul is an archetype. Paul himself is such an archetype of so many things. We consider him a great pioneer. He's the first missionary we sort of see and follow to watch what a missionary does. And church planter. He's the first prolific church planter that we follow. He's sort of archetypal of the epistolary writer. You know, he writes the letters to churches. Great apostle, great missionary, great theologian. He sort of is a symbolic first or archetype of so many things. And as I said last week, one that's often forgotten is that Saul is an archetype of a persecutor. Before he was a pioneer in those other areas, he was a pioneer in persecution, a patron saint of persecutors, if you will. And he showed how it's done. And remember, I said sometimes these things have patterns that go on and on and on. And so there was a pattern of persecution Saul established that you see throughout all time. Remember, the pattern was Saul, here's what the Christians teach and preach. He doesn't like what they teach and preach. He really hates what they teach and preach. And he disagrees with it so much that he doesn't just say, you guys are wrong. And he doesn't just go out and publicly confront them and say, you're wrong. He wants to stop them. He wants to destroy them for it. He wants to prevent them from getting the chance to ever speak it. And in order to do that, Saul enlists the help of the state. He goes to use the powers of government. He goes to get those letters. And I said, this pattern you will find all over the world throughout all time. People will hate what the church teaches sometimes or preaches, and they will not like it, and they will disagree with it so much that they don't just want to say we disagree with it, they want to shut the church down. They want to close their doors. They want to get them out. They want to push them into a dark corner, never to be heard from again. And in order to do that, they will use the powers or the levers of the state when they can. Saul, he beautifully set that tone early and showed how that's done. And he's off to carry it out when this event happens. And so we see patterns, but here's a question for us today since we're looking at the conversion of the man. Is the dramatic conversion of Saul a pattern What do we think about conversion? He's one of the first and most famous conversions. So what do we learn from his conversion? And what does his conversion teach us about the whole idea of conversion? Is it a pattern? Are dramatic conversions like this, we're all impressed by them. I mean, they're great stories. They're powerful testimonies. And they're effective witnesses to people. But, I mean, how many conversions are going to be like that? And is a less dramatic conversion less authentic, less legitimate? Is it lesser in some way? I mean, when any crowd in any church hears someone give a powerful, remarkable, dramatic conversion story, how many of the people in that crowd say to themselves as they hear it, "Wow, that's just like my story," versus how many in that crowd say, "Wow, that's nothing like my story"? Well, we do have to understand this whole idea of conversion. This account makes us ask these questions. And so some key points to draw out of it, some things to say, not just that they don't just come from this passage, but trying to take a wider biblical understanding. How does a Christian rightly consider what conversion is? And how should that apply to me and other people? Well, it's a central theological question. I mean, this is at the heart of everything we believe. This is part of your understanding or your doctrine of salvation itself, what the theologians call your soteriology. Here are several terms, then, that you'll know that the Bible uses to refer to the notion of salvation. You will know there are probably more than this, but here are several Bible terms, words the Bible uses to talk about what salvation is. And the first one's built from the word I just said, saved. It's the word we use all the time, saved. How about redeemed, ransomed, purchased, born again, / regenerated, made new, adopted, made whole, forgiven, made alive, freed, liberated, rescued, restored, delivered, made clean or pure, a child of God, a believer, a follower, a disciple, and so on. Those all sound fairly familiar to you? They should. But now, all of these part of the, you know, they're all part of the picture of what a newborn believer is. And there's something about what happens. There's something about conversion initially that's kind of beyond what we can map out. We can't predict it. You know, the wind blows where it will. That's why the message goes out. You can't say that one will believe, that one's probably elect, that one's probably a sure thing. There's a future Christian over there. Not you so much. Probably not you. We can't do that. You don't know who's in and who. You don't know who will say what, who will respond or when. So there's a mystery to it. There's part of it we just can never predict. We can't diagram it and we can't program it. You know, so some of us who want to program everything out, you'll never program that. You just don't know who will be among those who were the converted and who will say no and who will always say no. So the theologian Stanley Grimes, a well-known theologian, says this about this. He says, despite its centrality to our faith, conversion remains a mystery. Exactly how the great transaction transpires, how God brings us to know Him, is just beyond our comprehension. There's part of what conversion is that's just God's business, that we can't put our finger on it. We just don't know. The Spirit blows where it will. And things just happen in the lives of people. So that part of it, at the beginning, initially, it's quite mysterious. Conversion starts with God's work. All God's work. God's mysterious work. It's all His doing. But the ongoing result of conversion is not quite as mysterious. It's more evident. It's something you can watch happen. It's more plain to see. The ongoing result of it is something you can visibly see. And so when we come to biblical language then, I'll give you a couple of terms, tell you a couple of terms here that depict, I think, some of these differences between the one-time event that we often call conversion, what happens in Acts 9 in the beginning, is a sudden event. I mean, it's just sudden. It's like, I'm going along, I'm taking a trip, I'm headed to Damascus, boom! You know? Like, that's a quick one-time, cataclysmic type of thing. So there's a suddenness and a one-time event that happens as part of conversion, but then there's also an ongoing process. Let me ask you, was that the end of Saul's story? Is it like, yay, terrible persecutor becomes Christian, the end, roll credits? That's just the beginning of his story, really. It's the end of something. It's the end of his past life, his former ways. It's the end of the persecutor's life. It's the end of that lost and wayward man who was confused about Christ and who he was, who had it wrong. It's the end of that guy's life. But it's the beginning of another man's life. It's a new person now, and we're just seeing the beginning of it. So the one-time element, often the word used there in the New Testament is a word called epistrepho. I'm not showing you this one this time. I'm just saying it. Epistrepho, Greek lesson. So the word strepho just means to turn. It's a little prefix on it. It's a little preposition that this adds emphasis to it. You know, just add, it's an emphatic turning. An emphatic turning. It's similar to another word. In the Hebrew, there's a word like it. And the prophets would say it all the time when they'd be talking to Israel. Isaiah 55, seek the Lord while he may be found. Call upon him while he is near. Let the wicked forsake his way, and the unrighteous man his thoughts. Let him turn to Yahweh, that he may have compassion on him. It's sometimes translated return. So that's in Hebrew. The prophets said it all the time. But you get this Greek word used by the New Testament writer. So in Luke 1, the angel tells Zacharias that he and Elizabeth's unborn son will, quote, turn many of the sons of Israel back to the Lord their God. John the Baptist, he will turn, that's that word. Peter used it back in chapter 3 when we were looking at the big sermon he preached to the crowd. And Peter says to them after he's said all this stuff, he says, okay, so now repent and turn, he tells them. Every one of you, turn. That's the word. And that turning is that first part of conversion. It's that change. You know, the will changes. The mind changes. The heart changes. The attitude, the disposition. There's a sudden thing that happens in people. In fact, this word, this same word is actually translated conversion. One time. In most of your English Bibles, in one time, in Acts 15:3, this is way down the road in the story. Paul's a missionary, and he and Barnabas are passing through, and they're giving good news about how their missions are going, and they're telling the Christians about all the people who are believing the message. And it says there in Acts 15 that they traveled through Phoenicia and Samaria, quote, recounting in detail the conversion of the Gentiles. And this news brought great joy to all the brethren. So they're telling them about the conversions, the turnings, same word. So there's that sudden part of it. There's that thing that happens. But there are other words used that talk about conversion in this sanctification part. There's a process. You keep being changed. And so, you're familiar, I know, from past sermons. No doubt you remember them all so well. Metamorphose. Metamorphose. Remember that Greek? Transformed. Most prominently and best known in Romans 12, chapter 2. No longer be conformed to the pattern of the world, but be transformed. But that's when it's used there, it's a sort of present tense. It bespeaks ongoing action. So there it's not just saying, hey, do this one-time thing. It's saying, you got to keep living this way. Continually let your mind be changed and altered and conformed, not to the old pattern of thinking and to the wrong pattern of thinking, but let your mind be renewed. It's sort of ongoing. And there, conversion is part of your ongoing sanctification. This is the same word used in the Gospels when Jesus takes the three up to the mountain, remember? And it says that he is transfigured. Remember that? That's the transfiguration. That's the same word. He's metamorphosed. He suddenly changes in front of them. He no longer looks like just that regular old guy anymore. They see him in a sort of more glorious light, as closer to his true divine identity. And so this change. Now, that doesn't mean that, I mean, the words are used in different ways. But it's certainly used here. It's not, notice, it's just not, we don't read about just get converted. Just get converted. That's all. That's your job, get converted. And then your job's done. And your job with other people is go convert them. And when you get them converted, you're done with them. That's not how we live. Conversion is both the one-time act that's more mysterious. God accomplishes it. It's God's doing. But then it continues going. It's ongoing, the process of change. And the converted man to the converted woman undergoes this for life. Salvation and sanctification. So this makes sense to you? Yes, this notion of conversion. I want you to see the both tenses of it so that nobody thinks to themselves, well, I mean, I already did that, so I'm done. You ain't done. You still got some, there's still some converting to do as part of your sanctification. You're not in the right shape yet, right? Paul himself, who was converted in chapter 9, says lots of times later, I'm not there yet. I'm not there yet. I got a ways to go. So his conversion was immediate in one sense, but then it was ongoing as he continues to be transformed in the later time. So conversion is supernatural, always. It's always God's doing, but we're always called to be transformed. Work out that salvation that He worked in you. But conversions are always supernatural in the sense that no one can just pull it off. Nor can you go and say, well, let me roll up my sleeves and I'm going to go convert that guy. You convert nothing. You couldn't convert you and you can't convert him or her. It's not how that works. There's something supernatural in conversion. But what if it doesn't look that supernatural? Paul's conversion is supernatural. Light from heaven. Wow. I mean, just crazy. Outlandish. That's sensational. The conversions of most of the saints of all the ages were, frankly, not the kind of stuff you'd make a Christian movie about. They're not all that dramatic. We have a hankering for the sensational. Our whole culture is like that, right? That's what we like, stuff that makes news. And if it's sensational, it's attention grabbing. So like that headline of the Muslim guy, now that's pretty sensational. Wow, that's amazing. Stories like that get our attention. But frankly, most of the people throughout all the ages who were some of the finest Christian believers who ever walked the face of the earth, their conversions weren't as overly dramatic as that. But were they less miraculous? Were they in any way lesser? They were not. Very few conversions are as overtly dramatic as that of Saul. And that's because, thankfully, very few people were ever out actively hunting down Christians. Now that's good. I mean, I wouldn't want a world in which everyone who to be a Christian, to have genuine conversion, you must have been on the war path against the church and violently opposing the church. Some people didn't appear to be doing so. So most people don't have a story quite like Saul's. It is not God's ultimate design that everyone needs to have been the most egregious, obvious kind of sinner in order for there to have been conversion. Like I said, conversion happens in a place and in a way that you don't always see. There's something invisible and remarkably supernatural. It happens in people, and that happens in all people. Not just the most sensational, worst, wicked criminal who has committed all the most heinous sins. And see, if we think that, if we wrongly think that, we will fall into a few different errors. One of the errors we will commit if we don't watch out is we will start to think that those who never had heinous sins in their past, who weren't the most egregious kind of offenders, don't need conversion. We might wrongly convey to the outside world that only if you're a terrible person, the worst kind, do you need conversion. And if you're not, and you don't have heinous sins on your record, well, I mean, you don't really have anything to repent of. I mean, why do you need to be transformed? You're a decent person. You're an okay law-abiding citizen. You're not too bad. You know, no blood on your hands. You ain't never killed anybody. You pay your taxes. You know, you're pretty decent. So you're not a conversion candidate. That's what we will tell people. But of course, as we well know, the truth is that if you are human, if that is your species, okay, if you're a member of this race, if you're human, then you share the same sin nature as the most vile offenders. And therefore, technically speaking, in the eyes of God, you're not in any better shape. You share the same nature, and therefore you need conversion. And you must be born again, as it says. So, look, only those, I mean, to qualify for conversion, you need only fall short. of perfection. If you've done that, you're a candidate. And if you've done that, in fact, it's not just you're a candidate. You're in desperate need. Well, I'm a decent person, but you're still in desperate need. All of our righteousness is as what? So pretty good, okay? It's filth. Well, that's but I try to do good. But we fundamentally misunderstand the nature of the character of God and the nature we bear. And so we don't want to convey to the world that only the worst of you need conversion and the rest of you are okay. We can also, if we don't watch out, commit another error, fall into another mistake of thinking if we see this wrong. And that is, we can kind of create a church culture that either over-glamorizes dramatic conversions or we look down our nose at those who are like that. Like we're jealous or we despise them. You don't want to be a church that looks at those who came from the bad background, whose conversions were really crazy, like I was in prison and I would... You don't want to be the church that says, well, you're lesser than. We don't want to be the big brother, right, who's kind of resentful that the prodigal came home. That's part of the point of that whole story, is to say, don't be like that. That's one, we can commit that error. Or we can over-glamorize those people. We can overly sensationalize them in such a way that they're like, some converts are celebrities. And then by contrast, everyone who doesn't have that is not, you know, you're not as cool. And examples, what happens then is sometimes examples of children and youth and young adults who have basically been faithful and haven't been utter fools and thrown their lives down the gutter, they somehow are made lesser because of that. Like we fail to appreciate and celebrate faithfulness if we overly celebrate and glamorize those things. You may know that there have been high-profile testimonies in some cases. High-profile testimonies of people who went around to churches and gave their sensational testimonies of where they came from. And in some cases, those have been proven false. Which is to say that some people, yes, have lied about their past to enhance the drama of their conversions. There was a young guy, I remember when I was in high school or whatever, here in the city, and he was going to different churches because he had this background. And then it turned out, people found out he had made a lot of that stuff up. There was also a man who I think was an effective kind of preacher, evangelist, but he was also a comedian. What's his name? Warnke or one of those from back in the... And, you know, what his past was supposed to be that he was this Satanist of some kind, right? Devil worshiper. And look, what's going to get, you know, in a lot of churches, what's going to grab the attention of people more than devil worshiper? And this was his background story. But he found the Lord, and here he came. And it's like, wow, that's a cool story. The problem was he had made a lot of that up. Some of that, there's a bunch of it wasn't true. What would possess you to do it? Well, only the pressure to be that celebrity convert. Well, that's just not necessary. We don't need to do that. We don't want to foster the big brother complex against them. Nor do we want to overly celebrate the conversions of people to make them celebrities. Is the ideal in Scripture that every child growing up goes off the rails and is in such bad shape that a dramatic conversion is required? Is that the ideal? Does Scripture say that? Is the advice given? How about this for a Mother's Day message, huh? Mothers, make sure your kid goes way off track, because we're going to need dramatic conversions, and we can't pull them out of the pit of absolute destruction unless we make sure they go into the pit of absolute destruction. We need some drama around here. What kind of advice would that be? So, the goal then, what's that? Heathen, she says. All right, I like it. All right, heathen. That would be ridiculous. It would be absurd. You would think, what? Clearly, throughout Scripture, read Proverbs. You know, what does Proverbs say time and again about how you raise kids? You know, it doesn't say, make sure they experience all the worst so that they can appreciate how much better things are. You know, frankly, in this world, you don't have to try that hard with a lot of kids. I mean, there's enough pull that way that you don't have to push that way. And so therefore, the goal is that Christians raise their kids well, that they do not depart from it, right? That they do not depart from it. And they avoid the worst of the foolishness in the world and the pain and the enslavement to every sin known to man, that they would need a dramatic conversion. However, they still need the power, the power of the rebirth that Christ, they still need that. They still need conversion, even if they're pretty good. But if they're pretty good and they're taught well, they'll understand that pretty good is a worldly diagnosis. That's a measuring stick that is not a biblical one. If they're raised correctly and their theology is right, they'll understand that even though I'm not out doing all the worst, terrible sins in the world, the fact is, I'm an unrighteous, sinful person. And I must lean on the righteousness of Christ, or I am not accepted by God. And I got no future in the church if I'm not a converted person. They'll know that. And in that sense, you see, their conversion is every bit as supernatural as Saul's was. Well, my last point here is that the lives of the converted are proclamations of the gospel. People preach by how they live, and especially when people see the transformation. It's a loud kind of a testimony, even without words. Whereas by contrast, by the way, very unsanctified people who use their words to talk about what great Christians they are, they provide the bad testimonies that robs the gospel of its credibility. But if you want the gospel to have real power and real credibility, just show what happens. You know, there are places in the world right now where the church is growing, very unlikely places, by the way. You see it in China, you see it in Iran. Headlines coming up, the church growing. Why would it be growing? A lot of people look and they see how Christians are living in tough circumstances, and they see transformations taking place, both sometimes dramatically in a one-time situation and then ongoingly, and then they say, that's impressive. And that message is powerful to them. The great historian Philip Schaff, who wrote a long history, says this about the church and her message. He says, its value could be seen by people in the truth and self-evidencing power of its doctrines, the church's doctrines, and in the purity and sublimity of its precepts, but also in its regenerating and sanctifying effects on people. The regenerating and sanctifying effects on people is part of what really makes it attractive and people are drawn. I read this to you once before, I think, but it was just so amazing, from this article way back in 2009 about in Christianity Today dealing with the problem of the AIDS crisis in places in Africa. And it was saying that there are activists who do work there who are non-Christian. But when they look at what the Christians do there, they can't help but be impressed. And there was a great quote by a man in that article that I thought was astounding. And the man's name was Matthew Paris. And what's astounding about the quote is that he identifies himself as a gay man and an atheist. But he's been involved doing work there, and he defended what the church does there just based on what he sees in terms of results. And that man is quoted as saying, quote, in Africa, Christianity simply changes people's hearts. It brings a spiritual transformation, and that rebirth is real, and that change is good. He's saying, this really helps. This really is helping. I mean, that's just a pragmatic approach, but who knows? See, it's a guy like him who might look at that. And that's a message that preaches in a powerful way. So, look, if you had met Saul of Tarsus before what happened in Acts chapter 9, we would have been tempted to think, this guy's hopeless. This guy's the worst of the worst. We might have been tempted after Acts 9 to distrust his conversion, like some did, didn't they? I still don't trust him. Or we might have held his past against him. I'll never accept you in the church. I'll never really accept you after the past you had. But the church, you see, is made up of entirely converted people. There is no member of this body, of anybody, anywhere. There's nobody in the church who is not a converted person. Because if you are not a converted person, you are not part of the church. You may be physically worshiping with the church or near the church or around the church, But it's only converted people. So no convert can look at another one and say, you're no good. And so some people then, a lot worse than others. They were worse. Some of us might have been worse by the world's standards in our past. Some conversions will always be more dramatic than other conversions. But every believer was equally lost and hopeless apart from God. And I know that all of us here, you know people that you wish would be changed. Don't forget, now that's God's business, ultimately. Only God does it. You can line up countless testimonies to prove how miraculous that has to be. Don't ever despise the prodigals who come home, though. And don't glamorize sensational testimonies at the expense of the rest of them. Teach and train the young so as not to require them someday to have to experience a dramatic conversion. But if they do, you will praise God for it.